different than ugly radio.
Good morning and welcome to WNHHFM's Dateline New Haven, the show that is different from ugly radio, but the same station and the same vibe. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Tamiko Jackson MacArthur makes New Haven tick. She serves on the Board of Education, a thankless, unpaid community service, if it ever was one. She's a pediatrician, and she follows everything going on in town. She's here in the WNH studio to talk about all that. Welcome, Tamiko, and thanks so much for coming in.
Paul, thanks for inviting me. I love being here. I really love you. Yes, it's amazing. Thank you.
And we love having, I also want to thank you on the Haven Hospital for providing financial support for today's program. Tamiko, you have been in the midst of a lot of controversy, not you personally, but controversial issues at the Board of Education. Yeah. What have you been on there, like 2 years?
2 years.
Feels like 20?
It feels like a long time.
And you don't get paid to be on that, right?
No, I don't.
But you do get the honor of sitting through very long meetings where people get very upset about stuff.
Yeah.
And making decisions that are very important for 25,000, is it, public school
about
students? 22,000.
Yeah, around 22.
That's a lot. So one thing that's happened that's a big deal is we now have our, let me just count, it takes me a minute. Fourth school superintendent in 4 years. And Babs was obviously, she's my kid's pediatrician and my sorority. Thanks for listening, Babs.
Hi, Babs.
So that's a big deal, right? And we know that all over the country, police chiefs, school superintendents are serving a lot shorter terms than they used to. There's a lot more churn. There's more transparency, more people weigh
people
in on stuff. There's
speak up now.
Yeah, and you're not supposed, like when Dean Esmond almost made it to 5 years in New Haven, you know, his first four went smooth and then, you know, boom. And that was considered long compared to his predecessors. So Carol Burks was brought in after Garth Harries was run out. That's before you, the superintendent.
You said run out.
He was run out of town. Reggie Mayo was brought in temporarily, but that stretched out to a year and a half. You were on the board when you chose Carol Burks.
No, I wasn't.
Oh, you weren't yet?
No.
Okay, Carol Burks was chosen in a controversial process.
I was on the interview committee, but I wasn't on the board.
And was she your choice?
I had a couple of finalists.
Mm-hmm. And she was one of them.
Yeah.
Okay, and then she was chosen as superintendent. And then in the view of outsiders like me, but you're going to inform us from the inside, my sense was she never really got a chance to do that job because from the day one, the fighting began. She was kind of undercut when she tried it. They said, come in and make big decisions. She made some big decisions. Then people said, how dare you make those big decisions, big rallies, fights, whatever. But in any case, her whole 18-month tenure was marked by controversies with her and the board, with her and parents, with her and teachers. And now she's been run out. Well, I'm sorry. She reached an agreement to leave with 18 months left on her contract.
Yeah, she wasn't.
And now you have Eileen Tracy, who's a veteran.
Yes.
Kind of a, what I, fair to say, a calm helmswoman.
Seasoned.
In the storm. Yep.
And you know, she's consummate professional.
Very, I believe, very popular principal at King Robinson.
And she was, yes.
And then she became an administrator in these. So she's now there. I believe the temperature level has dropped, has it not?
You know, it has. And I remember this past Tuesday after the meeting, driving home, I said, wow, that was easy, almost like the Staples month. That was easy. You know, we made some decisions, but it wasn't as stressful as the meetings have
so
been.
So why has there been that much stress, and why have we been through four superintendents in 4 years?
Well, I think that our district, being as large as it is it's challenging, and we have a lot of challenges because we have a lot of different, you know, cohorts of kids that we need to make sure we provide the best education for. And if you can't quite grasp that or understand the village that needs to be there to make that happen within our district, then it doesn't work.
And isn't that true when I say, like, let's take Garth Harries, and I'm really not weighing in on whether he should have been driven out or not, but he worked pretty hard at stuff. He had been an assistant superintendent. People feel very strongly on different sides about issues like influence of charter schools, or he turned Hill House High School into a lot of mini schools. Some people didn't like that. So there was this move to drive him out by a newly empowered, partially elected Board of Ed. Mm-hmm. But after he left, some of the results came in pretty well for some of the changes he made, such as
I liked Garth.
I
had no problem with him, although there was a lot of pushback with Garth. His style was different. He came from a different angle because I don't think he was an educator. I don't think it was an
educator.
He
had never taught in a public school. He had a tiny stint in a private school.
Right. So, you know, and New Haven is a very strong-minded city.
Yeah.
And when New Haven gets something on her mind and wants to go in a different direction, if you're not willing to take that ride and see how you can participate in that, how you can influence that, then you'll have a hard time.
Is that what happened with Carol Burks? But what happened with Carol Brooks?
So, you know, I'm going to speak for myself. I can only speak for myself. And just to let you know, I've known Carol Brooks for a very long time. I'd had no clue when I was on the interview committee that she was interviewing. So when she came, I was very surprised. And probably because I'm not in education, so I didn't follow her career and I wasn't following her career like that. I think that there were a lot of different opinions in play, and Dr. Brooks had a very rough time in getting what she wanted done because it wasn't, like I stated before, that direction that a lot of people wanted to go into.
And what did that mean? That mean bringing in consultants costs a lot of money to redo things? Did it mean laying off part-timers? Did it mean not communicating well? Or did it mean that anytime you do something big, people who don't like it will find a way to jam it?
So I think for me, you know, I really can't, you know, I can only speak for myself, you know. I think there could have been better communication.
I have to say that when I watch someone like you on a board of ed, and you're someone whose opinion I've always taken so seriously, like I think, you know a lot more than I do about the way things work in town. And I just think you're so fair. So when all that stuff was happening with Carol Brooks, I thought at every step, you were like a model board member, because it was never like, I'm out to get Brooks, I'm going to make excuses for Brooks. My job is just to take each issue as it comes. And what are the pros and cons, and make a decision. I never felt you're out to get her. I never felt you're trying to protect her.
Thank you.
I felt you're just doing your job.
And that's the way I was trying to do it. And
was that hard though?
It was very difficult. It was a very difficult months, year and a half, because I really want the district to move forward and to succeed in educating our children. Yeah. I grew up in New Haven, and I grew up at a time when it was the educational system was very tough. It was going through a lot of struggles. And
what are we talking about? 80s? I'm like 10 years older than you, aren't I?
80s.
Yeah. It's like, what year did you graduate from high school?
86.
Yeah, we're a decade apart almost.
Yeah. So.
And William Outlaw says hi to Miko. Thanks for listening.
What's up?
Oh, by the way, he's got a great new book.
I got his book already, and I'm waiting for him to come and sign it, and I've gotten through half of it already.
I read it. It is amazing.
It is excellent.
First of all, it's eye-opening what was happening in town, but also the way it shows up close how you can save lives. How a person can turn around his life, and then I never really understood the detail of it. When you see 20 people outside the hospital because someone's been shot, and someone like June Boy Outlaw, who used to be in the life, he's now a student outreach worker, can look into the crowd and he picks out the one guy who he can see is there to shoot somebody in retaliation.
And let me tell you, we need June Boys on that scene.
And then he gave permission. So it's like all these people, he understood that it's a macho thing, that if someone got shot you're close to, your pride is at stake. So you got to shoot him back. And he's the only one who could tell them, don't. Because if Joan Boy, who ran the biggest gang in town in the 90s and was tough and killed a man.
And let me tell you
something. If he tells you you don't need to do it for your pride, it kind of almost gave. A lot of people are alive today because of that.
Yeah, it validates it. And I can tell you this. I've known Joan Boy almost all my life because I grew up over by the island.
Well, he didn't. Well, yes, he lived there in his late teens.
Yeah, he was there. So although he was across town, I knew him from out Front Street. So,
where he was first born, according to Key Terrace.
Yeah, so.
I learned all this from reading the book, yeah.
Exactly. And you don't know that all that is going on. And so I give him so much love.
It's an incredible inspiration.
For all of this, yes. It and the book is amazing. Good. So he needs to get to my office and sign that thing.
I think it is true. He can go save lives, that's fine, but he's got to get to Miko's office to
sign that book.
All right, and Drew Sykes says somebody from the city needs to be involved in the schools. Thank you, Drew. So what year did you graduate? I mean, what school did you graduate in 86?
So I graduated from Sacred Heart Academy. I'm a Shaw girl. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I did not go to public school. It was very challenging. My parents both worked their butts off to send me to private school from kindergarten to 12th grade. Mm-hmm. But I now have educated my children in public school.
Your kids go to what schools? Or if you don't want to say, that's fine.
I don't mind since it was blasted. they were at King Robinson from pre-K 3 to 5th grade and to 6th grade. 5th grade. And then they started Betsy Ross last year.
That's where they are now?
That's where they are now. And
they is how many?
Two. I have twins.
Oh, twins. Okay.
I have 12-year-old twins.
And how do you feel as a public school parent? Do you think it was a good decision? Because I have mixed feelings. I'm glad my kids went to the public schools, but I'm not. They also spent some years at a religious school, and I have, you know, pros and cons.
I think that, you know, I think the classroom sizes are much too large. Mm-hmm. And that's something we need to work at. But as far as my children are concerned, I'm fortunate enough to be able to give a lot of outside things, which a lot of people can't. So
I think they call that enrichment now. When we were kids, there was no such thing as enrichment.
It's still called enrichment. So I know that's the
Does that mean like dance lessons, gymnastics,
you
acting?
You know, one of my kids is in acting school and he does acting. He does musical theater. He does hip hop. He does tap.
And where is that?
He goes to NOAPA, New Haven Academy of Performing Arts, which is amazing.
And he also goes to an arts high school, junior middle school.
Yep. And he goes to dancing school at for hip hop and tap at, Hamden Academy of Dance and Music, Haddam. My daughter is a competitive dancer and she's basically dancing 3 hours a day at the same dance school, Haddam. They also, you know, any other thing they want to do, like little day trips to the city, Boston, wherever, I do that.
So you're a full-time pediatrician. You're on the board of ed, which is a big job, and it sounds like you're a taxi driver. I mean, are you driving all over town?
I have a minivan.
Do you pick them up from school and go to Hamden, then go to the other
place?
Yes,
I pick them up from school and I go to wherever they need to go, wherever we're gonna go. You know, we're doing DIY costumes for Halloween, so we have to go to all the thrift stores to get the right things. You know, we got the basic thing from Amazon, but there are other things we need to add to it, and we go to the thrift stores and get it. I'm first and foremost a full-time mom. Everything I do is for the legacy of my children, to make sure not only am I teaching them, but I also leave them a map, a road, a guide, mm-hmm. kind of like my parents did.
Always felt like my kids are grown up now. I was just at my granddaughter's family's home for the Sukkot holiday. I remember while you're the parent, you're on a state of alert. You don't realize it until they leave the house. Every minute, like, are they safe? Are they getting what they need?
Anyone who knows me, Babs knows this. I'm always like... I worry constantly, and I never understood why my mother was like that. I'm my mother. I can't believe it, because it's so anything could happen. And right now, I think it's a little more critical than back in the days, because the internet has people with their fingers on your kids 24/7.
My daughter's not putting her kid on the internet at this point.
I tried to stop it, but
how do you do it in middle school?
You can't. You can't, but, you know, I can give this little tidbit. My kids aren't watching this. They have iPhones, and they are on my Apple ID. Every phone call and every text comes to me.
All right. And I heard your next career in the Grow Up is going to be the NSA.
What? Oh, yeah, I know. Right?
But first, as of today, Tomiko MacArthur Jackson is a member of the Board of Ed. She's a pediatrician. She's the woman who knows New Haven. And she's here on Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM. Honda Smith says, hello, Dr. Jackson, speak the truth about the city. Thanks for listening, Honda, and weighing in. Uh-huh. And Babs says, the only woman I know who loves a minivan. So we got a little off track. So you know about what it's like to have kids in the public school. You know about Arlene Tracy's legacy because your kids went to King Robinson.
Well, let me tell you, there's a quick story about that. When they were going to start King Robinson, she left. I wanted them to go there because of her. And I called her and said, we're going to start school late because we take our vacations a little bit later. One of our vacations is a little bit later in August, which we have fixed since then. But I said, oh, we're going to be late. But when I got there, she wasn't there. I was so disappointed. But the person that filled in for her was amazing. So
now Arlene Tracy's filling in for Carol Burks.
Yes.
Although is Carol Burks gone? She hasn't signed her departure deal.
Yeah.
I mean, she agreed to it with you guys. You negotiated it. So you had a deal.
Yeah.
You put Arlene Tracy as acting.
Yeah.
But now she hasn't signed it. What's that all about? That's weird.
I don't know. That's all at the lawyers. Like, I'm just waiting.
So
like
what happens
else.
If she doesn't sign it? Oh. You have to fire her based on
I do not know.
Valuation?
I don't want to talk about that because that is not where we want it to go, right?
Okay.
We don't want to go there, do we, Paul?
Let's go to what Arlene Tracy is going to do. How long is she in? There's going to be a search. Is she going to be the permanent superintendent or is she interim?
I don't know. We haven't even got there yet. I think right now we need to cool the coals because it's been mm-hmm. so on fire, and she's the right person to bring in, I think, that calmness, that coolness. As you can see from the last meeting that we had, it was excellent. So I think she's the right person to act as interim. When we're going to start, I don't know. I leave that to Darnell to decide to work
he's
that out.
He's the president of the board.
Yes, he is.
But in either case, it'll be a while. Like
yes.
a search takes a while.
I absolutely hope so because there's a lot of healing that needs to happen, mm-hmm. and we don't need to be jumping into a search with open wounds.
So what kind of, how is this, what does that mean in practice for healing to happen at the Board of Ed?
Well, there was a lot of, I mean, publicly, there's a lot of lawsuits. We know that what they were filed on. And that just, if you see that in the public, there's other things under that. People were leaving. The atmosphere was, from what was told to me, the climate wasn't all that great. So that's healing that needs to happen.
So in other words, the people who are still there.
Yes.
Within the offices. And we're talking about, so we're talking about like in the main office, a lot of people left who are top administrators and some sued, like the chief financial officer, the woman who was in charge of like USTAD, they all sued her for mistreatment.
COO,
right, not financial. Financial. And you know, I think they all had a right to sue, and that showed there was a problem. Stepping back from the Board of Ed, I'm wondering how you run a public agency in the era of so many people filing lawsuits. Like in the ones, and those I see, you know, people definitely had a basis. So I'm not at all talking about the individuals who filed those lawsuits. I mean, it's an important American right. I wasn't in the room. I know the people filed them were very good people, so I'm not saying they did anything wrong. But how do you, anyone who's not going to like the decisions you make, how do you deal with that when they're always, do you basically have to have a huge line item? Like Tony Hart, the mayor, got sued a lot. I would say in the majority of cases, and her predecessors got sued, it's something a mayor does, right? So if someone speaks ill of you, or if they go against your decisions, or they get found out to have done something wrong, you fire them, then they try to find some way to get a lawsuit to cash in. That's not the case with the Burke suits, but I'm saying in government.
Right. So I think with the Burke suits, and this is, and I'm always going to say, this is just my opinion, that some of the facts that are in these lawsuits that are public, in my opinion, were avoidable.
Mm.
So if you have someone who was out on FMLA.
Right.
You,
that's family medical leave. And then her job got changed.
Leave that
and punished.
Alone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that obviously was a maneuver that you wanted to move your own person in. So you took advantage of some being
I don't
family
know
medical
why
leave.
That happened, because honestly, everyone knows FMLA, you leave it alone. So I don't know why that happened. It's unfortunate because that was totally avoidable. I'm not sure about, you know, with these other ones, they felt that they were spoken to. And if they were spoken to in a way that was not right, then if they approached the person and they didn't, you know, listen, okay, so now they have a lawsuit. But, you know, there are some things that I feel could have been avoidable, but that's just my opinion.
All right, Willie Booker says Auntie Belle is watching. Thanks for checking in.
Oh, hey, Auntie Belle. She's watching from Stockbridge, Georgia.
Whoa, welcome from Stockbridge, Georgia. So you talk about moving ahead and healing. So one thing you talked about is in central offices or the departures and lawsuits, you feel that having a steady hand, someone who's been there a while, will just help calm down how the schools are run. How is that going to affect the average student and parent and teacher? Like, I know one thing was with a lack of communication. I think we can agree about that. There was a whole screw up with thousands of people's bus routes being changed at the last minute, finding out, and turns out a lot of it was messed up. Because of lack of communications, people were getting fired, they're not fired. Because of lack of communications, there are going to be layoffs. What is it going to mean moving forward? If we have this period of calm with experience and clashing agendas not really coming to the head about anything, what will that mean for a teacher, a parent, and a student in the system?
So I think first and foremost for parents and for students, you know, Dr. Tracy has agreed to just whatever, as far as with the bus situation, she's just making that right. There was a lot of pushback, I feel, with the busing when it came out. Well, we got to do it this way. And there were a lot of dangerous bus stops, a lot of dangerous treks to get to a bus stop.
Yeah.
And I was very vocal about having it fixed immediately. And it was not fixed immediately. There were a lot of people working on it, but for whatever reason, it was lagging. They were doing it, but it wasn't going fast enough. Now, Dr. Tracy has taken the position that they are going to just fix it. If someone says, I don't like that corner, fix it. And I think that that is going to do a lot in making parents feel safe in the mornings and in the evenings with their children being picked up and dropped off. And that goes a long way. As a parent, when I feel that my children are safe, that goes a long way. As far as the staff in central office, they know her. They know how she works. She's fair. She's professional. She knows what she's doing. And I feel that they're going to actually let out a breath of fresh air and just sit back and kind of refocus themselves to get the work done.
Okay. And what about teachers? We had a budget. We had a tight budget. That's why Dr. Birx was, and again, I was agnostic on this. There were obviously problems with how it was rolled out, about mm-hmm. how people were notified. Although anytime people don't like a decision, they then argue about process rather than decision. Mm-hmm. You know, people got notices that teachers were transferred. They didn't always like that. Some people felt super, principals who made the call, which is the right way to do it, I think, might have used it for revenge for people who spoke up or whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff.
It looked that way in some situations, yeah, it did, which was sure. really sad.
Yeah, but I don't know how you avoid that in a big bureaucracy.
You know,
because you need principals to really run their school, and you need good principals.
You do.
And you're hoping that they don't. Maybe the message comes to the superintendent, look, don't use this excuse to get rid of that good teacher who you clash with.
So my opinion on that, and I have spoken to about people, is that when that was decided, there are assistant superintendents that are over, you know, a group of schools. And whoever the assistant superintendent was over that school, I felt that maybe they should have sat down with the principal and said, you're getting rid of so-and-so. Do you have any problems with this person? Is there going to be any pushback? You know, how did you come to this? There should have been a lot more, which I'm not saying that there wasn't a lot of thought, but a little bit more thought around how I thought it should have happened. I wasn't there. I feel that the communication, again, was not at the level it should have been. Folks were just really upset, really taken by surprise. Yes, they have the right to transfer people and all that stuff, but if you're going to do that, changing people's lives and all that kind of stuff, you owe them big time to really lay it out from A to Z.
And actually, you know, the reason I'm sympathetic to Carol Birx a little bit, I'm not saying pro or con, she should have stayed. She came in with this message, shake it up. Big changes fast. I mean, from some members of the public, you know. Oh. And obviously, then she went fast without communicating and doing it in ways people didn't like. And she's not really from here. I mean, so... I don't say, so yeah,
that's
I
what think, happened with the buses, you know.
Yep, that's what happened with the buses, happened with the layoffs, happened with some of the consultants. But anyway, we're all rooting for Dr. Tracy.
We are.
So let's talk about being a board ed member. What kind of difference can you make? Part of your job is to watch over and make things done right. So you hear about the bus stuff, get messed up, you press for answers. But you can also take initiative. And I think that you and Darnell Goldston, another board member, had a big win recently that will affect the lives of many parents and kids in this city.
Yes.
Which is that you noticed from people, you heard a lot from people that, hey, I move, in some cases they move near a magnet school. A whole separate discussion about why we have so many magnets. But the state, we had to deal with the state. You help us build these regional magnets, we'll set aside a lot of spaces mm-hmm. for suburban kids. But you noticed that a lot of kids weren't getting into magnet schools. Suburban kids were. And it wasn't just that we promised them spaces, but we felt the need to reserve extra spaces just in case, because we had a hard time getting suburban kids to come to these schools. Yeah. So instead of letting the local kid go to, let's say, Davis from down the street, the seat was empty.
Yep.
And it was all because of the cockamamie, unintentional consequences of the search for regional school desegregation.
Yes.
How did you change that? Because that was yeah. fast.
So let's go back to last year when we had the... we had the lottery, and, you know, people were just not getting into the schools they wanted to get into. We were getting a lot of calls, emails, and, you know, I put it on the line as chair of the governance. I said, listen, I want to talk about this. How is this working? And I've learned a lot from that, starting that ask. So first and foremost, unfortunately, the district brass, or whatever you want to call them, were not very supportive, because they said, we can't do that. They're never going to give you more seats. We need to figure this out some other way. But I kept pushing. I got the support of Darnell and the mayor. Keep pushing it. And they kind of jumped on board and said, no, we're going to look into this. And one of the things that we found out was that the district was using, the state asked for us to do a 75% New Haven seat versus a 25% suburban seat. But what the district has been doing, they were doing a 65-35 all along, because they wanted to put...
And you're talking about 65% seats go to New Haven kids,
35% go to suburban kids.
And what cracks me up about that is that idea was that out of the Sheff vs. O'Neill lawsuit for desegregation a couple of decades ago in Hartford, and they said, we'll build these schools so you desegregate, but then what happens is, say, you have to have suburban kids, but a lot of times suburban kids want to come who are black from Hamden or West Haven. Mm-hmm. And they can't get in. They're discriminated against for being black because you have to meet these formulas for race. So white kids who are privileged from the suburbs get to go to this great New Haven school.
Right.
And New Haven kids and suburban kids of color can't go. I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
And so we fought this and we told them we want this. And they were like, no, you have to. Because a lot of the schools, if we switched to 75-25, we were gonna hit that mark and they were going to wind up having to, you know, pay fines, which, let me tell you something. We weren't even reaching 25%. So why the heck were we making New Haven families suffer by not going back up to the 75%?
And not using the schools that were built to their full capacity.
I was very upset about that, and it really bothered me. It actually hurt me that the district would want to do that to our very own kids.
It's one of those things that in life often you say, well, this makes no sense. You look at it, it makes no sense. When you start looking to why it happens, each little part does make sense. Well, they built the school, state gave us money, so we have to reserve the seats. You have to make sure this balance is hit. So every step you know why someone decided something, but in the end, nobody was helped by it.
So long story short, we pushed it. We had all these meetings. They weren't against it. So we decided to say, okay, then we're going to charge tuition. We're going to go the tuition route. Maybe, you know,
we'll to the towns.
And the towns, we had a meeting. The towns were really, you know, some towns would have really been hit for a lot of money, and it would have not only would have devastated their funds, they wouldn't have had room to take any of those kids back because they build knowing that a certain percentage is going to come to our magnet, and specifically, you know, West Haven and Hamden. And we didn't want to do that to them either, because we really appreciate the collaboration of bringing the children in and everyone together. It actually is really a great thing, but we had to do something. So the state denied that because they said that we were running with a surplus. We're like, how are we running in a surplus?
Because Dr. Birx's administration got them some bad numbers. They didn't do the
they
math.
They sent
Not
a
that
letter.
I don't mean to criticize.
Well, they sent a letter that was wrong. So, you know, we were really upset about that. They invited us to a meeting at the state because they were like, you know, because we could have actually won that. If we really fought it right, we could have won that.
So did you go to the state education department yourself?
I couldn't because I had patients. I had to go. But Darnell went, a bunch of people from the district went, and because they said, we want to show you how we're going to really help you out. And after all that said and done, they did that. They gave us all those extra seats, which amounts to, you know, what, about 2 point something
million. In other words, you said, state, we're going to try again to charge tuition. They said, I'll tell you what, let's do a compromise. We'll give you what you're looking for. You don't have to go through this whole fight.
Back up a little bit.
We'll give you a rule. We'll change our rules. We'll be flexible, and you can put more New Haven kids in those seats.
And they
gave a huge win.
It is. And they also gave us—
changing something in government is big.
They also gave us a little leeway with this, you know, racial isolation numbers also. So it was a win-win for the city of New Haven, for the students, for the families, and for the board who really worked really hard. And I have to say that it was something that I felt passionate about. So thank you for recognizing
that. So I think to serve
that.
All those long hours, to actually be able to change something that involves state and local decision makers,
really
I think that's great. And Crystal K.B. Bethia says, okay, Tamika MacArthur, Dr. Jackson, Hart, love you. We're talking to Dr. Miko MacArthur Jackson on Dateline New Haven, WNHHFM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Miko's on the board of Ed. I want to ask you just in terms of your big, are there any other either big moments of satisfaction from your 2 years on the board so far, or a disappointment of something you tried to do and you found out you couldn't do it?
A little bit of something about me is that, you know, I've tried a lot of things that haven't worked in life, and I don't get too down about it. I look to see how can I change it up to get it, to make it happen. So I really haven't been that disappointed. But something that's happening that I do have a little disappointment. I'll tell you a little bit after this. I want to tell you this plus. So we really didn't know who was doing research in the district. We had all these people in the classrooms getting data. We're like, who are these people getting the data? And no one could really give you the complete list. So out of governance, I initiated the investigation in making our own IRB.
What's an IRB?
It is a institutional review board. So when people want to come into your institution or your organization to do, they have to give you the proposal and you have to read it.
That mean a consultant or an academic wants to do a study, like how many kids are getting free lunches, how many lunches get thrown out, how are their test scores
improving?
They have
to now come to the New Haven Public Schools IRB. And we have some very amazing researchers that are on that committee that will be part of this. They have to.
Does this mean that when someone studies us, they have to follow certain rules? Is that
yes,
the whole point?
Yes, there's certain rules. We want to know about your data, how long you're keeping it, where is it going to be kept.
And so that's so we don't become a laboratory animals for someone
well,
else's agenda.
Well, let me
agenda.
Tell you, look at 22,000 kids. Look at that sample. People want to get up in this district to do their research, and we stopped all of that free-for-all. And that came out of governance. That is another thing that...
So what would be an example of something you don't want them to be doing?
Okay, so let me tell you this. I once served on the state Human Investigations Committee, and I left. I left because they felt there was nothing wrong with a... there was a research that was being done on New Haven toddlers out of Yale, and they wanted to put ankle bracelets on these toddlers.
Oh my God.
To study their sleep. I went nuts. I said, how dare this even come across? And I knew the scientist who was doing it. And you know what? That drove me crazy. I cried about that.
And is the reason you didn't want them to be treated like prisoners before they're even in the
school
to prison pipeline?
Why would you even put an ankle bracelet on a toddler in the urban community? How do you even think that
so
that's
the question
okay?
is maybe researchers from different communities don't understand the urban community. Is
and,
that
then,
the point?
And we need to have some cultural competency here and understand what you're doing. So with that being said, when I was appointed the chair of the IRB, that was one thing that I wanted to investigate and to eventually happen. And we are now in our first session of IRB.
So IRB is new.
It is new.
And you chair it.
Yes. And I don't chair it, but I was the one that got it done.
Now, just so people can see this in a broader context, the first time I heard the word IRB was out of the famous Milgram experiments at Yale. Are you familiar with those?
No, but did they had to go, the IRB had to give them permission.
Well, at the time they didn't.
Oh.
This is what brought the big IRB movement in America at universities on human experimentation. So Stanley Milgram wanted to study the Holocaust. Why did Germans inflicting such torture and pain on people? So they had New Haven people come in and they hooked them up to a button and they said, when you press this button, the person in that other room gets an electric shock. It's a very famous experiment. Books have been written about this. In truth, they weren't getting the shock. It was an actor, but they didn't tell the people that. And in the course of the experiment, the person ordering them to give the shocks, over time, most of the participants wanted to please the person giving them commands. So at first they said, why would I shock that person? But by the end of the experiment, they started blaming the actor, who they didn't know was an actor. They said, that person's just not following rules enough. He needs that discipline.
Wow.
So all these everyday human beings were inflicting torture in their minds. So this is what was interesting about it to me, Go. On the one hand, like those researchers who wanted to put the ankle bracelets on the toddlers, they had in their mind a big goal. Like this was important human knowledge.
And that came out of Yale. They wanted to do that at the Yale PCC.
And so,
disgusting.
So there was important that the world wanted to understand how do we prevent Holocausts. But they lost sight of the human beings. This was traumatic for the New Haveners who came in under false pretenses being lied to, where they got turned into monsters.
Oh.
So this really hurt them. So this became a crisis for Yale and other colleges, and they set up IRBs, institutional review boards, so that now when you're doing human experimentation, like you served on for the state, that's how it happened.
Wow. Well, now we have one, and we have now a way to know who's in our district, who's doing what, and why.
Yeah, because New Haven's been studied so much. It's not always bad, right?
It's not always bad, but you know what? We need to know, though. We need to know, and it's not a free-for-all. You just can't come in here and do what you want.
Right.
Period. So one of my little disappointments, though, I think, was I have a little disappointment, and it's not a big disappointment because it's ongoing, is...
and Anika Michelle says no ankle braces. Thank you, Anika, for weighing in.
That's right. The Unified Code of Conduct. So the Unified Code of Conduct is something that's been trying to get off the ground. We have a lot of people working so hard on it. We have Kermit Carolina working on it, Gemma Joseph Lumpkin working on it. We have Joanne Wilcox work, a bunch of people, Ife, trying to get this uniformly throughout the school system. We did work on it during last semester.
What is it?
So the Unified Code of Conduct is basically a way to get all the schools to basically do the same thing around, I don't want to say punishment because it's not punishment, just how they initiate and carry out discipline throughout the school district.
Well, we started some core restorative justice.
A big part of it is restorative justice.
And we dramatically cut how often we suspend people. Like most of the people used to get suspended no longer get suspended, but we try to find ways to have them work with the teacher or the other students they did something wrong to make it right.
Yes, absolutely right. And that is the core of this, but not all schools will follow that. Not everyone is on that tip. You know what I mean? They don't want to do that. So part of the Unified Code of Conduct is unify the whole district. Now, we had it talked about at one of the sessions in August with the school building leaders, but it hasn't quite been really embraced the way I would like to see it embraced. So that's something that is a little disappointment to me, but it's just that it's taking a little bit
longer.
So in
other words, in 2 years, you had two big wins on the IRBs and the Magnet schools. Now you got something else to work on with the Unified Code of Conduct.
Yeah.
All right. Sounds like a summary for Tamiko MacArthur Jackson on the Board of Ed. You know, when you talked about research that might have great goals or how to change things, like I'm thinking of the different models of political leaders, and I'm not saying one's better than the other, but you talked about New Haven. We often have strong ideas about the way things should be done,
mm-hmm.
and experimenting with how to have models, what was called the model city. So I was thinking about the way Reggie Mayo and his chief operating officer, Will Clark, ran it. And I noticed something different with the people before and after them, which is that they led with the nuts and bolts. So the first day of school, they were personally at Meadow Street at the headquarters until long after school closed, like radioing or making contact with every school to make sure every kid got on the bus. Because there's inevitably some bus, you know, not like this year with 3,000 complaints, but there's some screw-ups always, right?
Right.
It's hard to manage big system, 22,000 kids. They really were nuts and bolts about, like, when they got money to fix schools, build them, how it's going to again. Real nuts and bolts about how the meals are going to be delivered from the central kitchen. They could talk to you about every big picture issue, like how do we change urban education?
Mm-hmm.
Big schools, size law, do we get ideas from charter schools or not and share? Do we turn Hill House into a mini schools or not? They could have that conversation just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But they led with the very nuts and bolts of, did the kids get on the bus? Did lunch get served? I feel like with Garth Harries, who cared about the nuts and bolts like anybody else, but his day began and ended and the priority was, how do we shake up education to get big new results based on the latest ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like Berks was kind of asked to do that too. And they didn't always have the same focus on the nuts and bolts getting right. And the same thing like in politics with mayors. You know,
right.
Historically, Doug Ray has a book called City, where he talked about Mayor Frank Rice 100 years ago. He was the sidewalk mayor. His idea was, my first priority is that the sidewalks get fixed. Dick Lee, who was a mayor, cared a lot about sidewalks, but his priority was, we're going to change the way cities run and get all this money for urban renewal and rebuild neighborhoods, and some of that didn't work out the way we wanted. And I just think there's an interesting push and pull that we have in our city and in our school system, more so than other places, because of the presence of Yale and because of this idea that everybody kind of has an idea how to make things better, which I don't think is necessarily bad. It's how do we navigate that?
Yeah.
So it sounds like IRB is one of the ways you're trying to do that.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, and then nuts and bolts every day, you're a pediatrician. How long have you been a pediatrician?
Oh, wow. So I've been a pediatrician since 1998.
Okay, why did you become a pediatrician?
You know, funny. true story. So I went to Head Start in the social hall of Quinnipiac Projects.
Oh.
And during that time, I was also in the Freddy Fixer, and the picture of me being the Freddy Fixer, I was dressed up as a doctor. So I like to tell that story because I think I was.
How old were you?
I was probably like 3 or 4.
What's so funny? I saw you as an adult on a float at the Freddie Fixer as a doctor. That's awesome.
Yeah. So,
Jaywan Carter, thanks for Jaywan. Said Dr. Mayer would pop up at different bus stops to wait for the bus to arrive.
Yeah, he would. So
I learned a lot from that guy.
When I was in actually med school, I decided I actually wanted to go into surgery, and I did my, what we call our sub acting, our acting, in, my acting internship, my sub I, whatever you want to call it, in surgery. My mother said, "Oh, you want to do that? What kind of life are you going to have? Don't you want a family?" I said, "Yeah, I do want a family." And I thought about 4 a.m. and I was like, that's not going to work for me. That's not the type of parent I think I want to be. It wasn't for me. So I said, you know what? I think I really like pediatrics.
Surgeons aren't taking their kids in the minivan to the Hampden Acting School.
Well, a lot
in the
of
middle
them
of
are.
The afternoon.
A lot of,
surgeons?
I mean, a lot of them are. When they, yeah. You know, when they get off. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a surgeon. I don't know. I mean, my friend, he's very active. I know someone, but
okay. I didn't think that
I could do it. So I decided to go into pediatrics. I trained in Newark at the Children's Hospital of New Jersey. After I left Howard, I went to Newark, and then I came back. No one here wanted to give me a job. Nobody. My father walked into St. Raphael's and handed my CV to Rick Young, who was the chair of pediatrics at St. Raphael's, a very small department. And he called me and he hired me. But no other place wanted to take me because I think they really feed off of the pediatric residency at Yale. You know, they're not
so
really.
So in New Haven, you kind of be in that Yale funnel.
Even though I was from New Haven, I was a daughter of the city.
That's so
coming back, I could not find a job. And
I would think the banners would be up in the parades. Welcome back. Corrine Smith-Holland says, and thanks for listening, Kay. Awesome pediatrician.
Thanks, Kay.
Kay's an awesome hairdresser.
She is. She is. So, you know, my dad really was instrumental. And he was like, no, my baby's coming home.
What did he do for a living?
Accountant. So, you know, he worked with Wendell for years.
Wendell Hart, yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, you know, and I came back and I started at St. Raphael's, and in 2006, I had a huge car accident, and it kind of opened my eyes to do what I want to do. And so I said, I gotta start my own practice. So that's kind of what was the impetus.
That's hard. Then you gotta be a business person.
Yeah.
And the boss is really mean when you have your own business.
You
I've
know,
learned that.
I don't know if I'm that mean, but I can flip that switch pretty quickly.
Okay.
It's very important for New Haven Pediatrics to provide, like, you know, excellent care, especially in the shadow of Yale. That
right. What do you provide as an independent person who grew up in New Haven and came back? What do you offer as a pediatrician that some of the larger practices and Yale affiliated practices don't offer?
So, you know, first and foremost, I offer a familiarity. I know a lot of the families in New Haven from growing up in New Haven. And when I was growing up,
we would walk from
neighborhood to neighborhood. I wasn't scared, you know. We would walk.
I feel like we're getting that back.
My friend Belinda and I would walk, believe it or not, we would walk from Quinnipiac Terrace to Churchy South.
Now, you grew up in Queen Terrace?
My parents bought their first house right next door.
Oh, okay.
And
Downing Street? Or?
No, we were Front Street.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And 366 Front Street. And
right
Belinda,
on the water.
And, yeah.
Is that Belinda Carberry? No.
No. Belinda Hannon.
Okay.
Hey, Belinda. I hope she's listening. But that's how I know everybody, you know. But I think I represent familiarity. I know the families. I know New Haven, period. That's how I know how tough
New Haven
is. And
talk about pediatrician. Of all medical doctor positions, I can think of no position that's more important to know your community than pediatrician, to know the kids and the families.
Yeah. I can tell you, I have parents that'll come in. They'll make an appointment and they come in, the kid's not with them. And I'm like, hey, what's going on? I need you to help me fill this form out. Sure.
When you weren't around as a doctor when my kids were little, we went to the famous Robert LaCamera and Dr. Wessel. And their insight was, and they never sold out to Yale either. And they really knew a lot of families. And their insight was you're treating the parent as much as the kid.
You are.
So we would always freak out, like, is my kid okay? So they would listen to see the parents' worry. So they knew that even if the kid fell off a skyscraper, he's going to be okay, but the parent was going to worry like crazy. Mm-hmm. So they always said, give him Benadryl. The idea was give him Benadryl because then you feel like you're doing something, and Benadryl sounds like
That's
a fancy
funny.
Word. Benadryl sounds like it's not
diphenhydramine.
It's not cough syrup. It's not vodka. It's some word, some weird word. And then the parents calm down so the kid be okay.
The kid will calm down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and working in the shadow of Yale, it kind of gives me a lot of, like, push, a lot of, like, powers that I feel like, you know, I'm going to fight them because, you know, there was a time.
What do you fight?
So, you know, little things. I have nurses, when people have babies, nurses tell them, oh, you're going to go to Dr. Jackson. Everyone goes to Dr. Jackson. Or you're going to go to Dr. Jackson. Do you know her? Or Dr. Jackson doesn't practice anymore.
What?
Let me tell you, there was also at one point, I don't go to the hospital anymore because they have hospitalists. So it's really, they offer a good service called the hospital service. And there are doctors that are employed by the hospital and they see your patients for you. So you don't have to waste the time and all that kind of stuff. So before when I would go, there was like a, when parents didn't know that where they were going to go for a pediatrician, there was a little card that they would show them. And they had pictures of all the clinics and a couple of private offices and not mine.
Was that because Yale has bought so many doctor practices that they're actually competing with you financially?
But this was before they were buying up the practices.
Oh, so why'd they do that? They just didn't respect the local people? They wanted their own?
I just think that Yale doesn't give a crap about anyone. You know, and I think that
do big institutions care? Can institutions care the way
no,
a human
because
can?
There's a lot. I really think that it's almost like you have too many people you have too many people working for you to do it.
And big institutions have their own logic.
They have their own logic
that aren't human.
You have their ER telling my patients, I'm going to call DCF just to ask them a question. Don't worry. I'm just going to ask them a question. I have them calling. They'll call me about something. And I'll say, well, you don't have to call DCF on this parent. This parent's been with me for 12 years. I know this family. Both parents work. You know, this happened at, you know, such a, then call me back. No, we're calling DCF on them. I say, you know what? The DCF worker could get up on the wrong side of the bed on the wrong day, go and break up a married couple, providing for their family, doing great. You know, use me like I told you to use me. But instead, they'd rather use DCF as a weapon of mass destruction. They use it to break families up. So, you know, they don't like me calling. I've been asked, why are you so angry? And I say, I'm angry because you're dumb.
Yeah, because you care. Kay Holmes says, my kids are in their 20s and they still want to call Dr. Jackson. I'm wondering if one of the most rewarding parts about being a community pediatrician is watching the kids grow up.
It is.
Have you any cases yet where you have the kids of someone who used to be your patient?
All the time now.
Tell me about that.
All the time now. So I have quite a few that are having their babies and they're coming. It's beautiful. It makes me really happy, but I always say I'm still young. You know, I'm not old yet. But they are coming back. I have infirmaries calling me, asking me to speak to my college-age patients to tell them to listen. Because they're like, we're not going to listen.
Sort of like the June boy outlaw of the medical practice.
I get on the phone.
If Dr. Carter Jackson says, Dr. Jackson says you can listen to them, you got permission.
Yeah. And I have to say, you better do it. And they listen to me. And that is, to me, one of the biggest rewards. You know, kids at my kids' school say, we love your mom. And my kids get proud. You know, it's amazing. I picked the right profession. I love what I'm doing.
That's awesome. We don't have enough time to talk about everything we want to talk about. Can I do a little lightning round on public health issues?
Okay.
Vaping. New problem for public health. Are you dealing with it? What's the deal?
It's awful, but the way we're going at vaping, we should be going after cigarettes too.
Mm-hmm.
Vaping.
Well, we're winning the battle on cigarettes because tobacco companies try to addict the teenager while their brain is more susceptible to addiction. They were losing that, so then they use the e-cigarettes to addict them more intensely than they did before because they've hacked the science.
And it's awful. I feel like you're inhaling that oil, and oil doesn't mix in your lungs. It's just disgusting.
And the incidence of smoking now has gotten way back up among teens.
Yes, it has. And with that, and also with, you know, the legalization of marijuana in a lot of places. Yeah.
And the sort of tacit legalization. When I walk down, you know, to work, I smell it every morning. Just about, yeah. You know, as you
and, you know, again. I believe that cannabis has its place because of a lot of medicinal properties. There's a lot of healing properties. But, you know, on the young brain, it can wreak havoc.
And so you're a school board member now. I know in Hamden and other districts, vaping is such a big problem. The bathrooms, the kids can't go to the bathroom all day. They can't leave them open all day. They have to have supervision at selected ones. The kids are holding it in. Is that happening in New Haven schools or
no? I'm not sure. I know of one incident. And it was taken care of. But we're, you know, preaching that, you know, come on, don't do that to your body.
Vaccinations. There was a lot of scare in the last year where some kids weren't getting vaccinated because of religious objections to the parents or believing some stuff that scientists say were nonsense coming from some celebrities. But that the fear was that if people don't, on the one hand, people say you should have the right as a parent not to vaccinate your kid. Other people say, but then you're endangering the public and the government needs to step in because of under 95% of the people, I think the number, I could be wrong about that, in a school community or a neighborhood or a vaccine where people are in contact with each other, then the viruses will spread and people will get sick and die.
Yes.
Who's right?
So I think everyone's right, but what we have to understand is the repercussions and what's going to happen. When I have quite a few families that seek me out because I have a policy of respecting the culture of the home. So if the culture of the home is that they don't vaccinate, so then how do we take care of this child so they're in their best health through their childhood, right? And that's how I work.
So you're not the government decision maker. You're the person who's actually dealing with each family and each kid.
Exactly. Now, when parents come in, oh, my kids aren't going to catch anything. Nobody gets that anymore. Well, we don't get anymore because we have that herd immunity. When the herd immunity does wane, when it goes down, we will start to see some very devastating illnesses. And
So how are you dealing with that as a doctor?
I talk to them about it. I'm frank. I say, you know, your child could die if they catch this.
Have you changed anyone's mind?
No. Well, no. But when you find out about MMR outbreaks, then they come in.
How many of your parents in your practice who come to your practice don't want to?
I don't know that number.
No, I mean like a lot, a few.
There's a couple every day because a lot of the practices in the area kick them out too. So they say, if you don't vaccinate, I'm going to kick you out. So I have families that come from.
So they come to you because you don't kick them out.
I don't kick them out.
And the reason because you want to make sure they're safe and other people are safe within
exactly.
the limits.
Exactly. You know, I'm about the health and well-being of the children of our community. And while I do support full vaccination as a pediatrician in the United States, I support full vaccination. But that's my choice. Mm-hmm. My goal, though, is to make sure that all the children stay healthy. So, you know, I can't fight the law, though, when the law changes. You know, that's not going to, I can't do that.
Danny McCullough III says, we love you, Dr. Jackson. Aww. 4 hearts on that message.
Yeah, I've known him all his life. He's my brother's best friend.
Allergies, I mean, that's something that older people like me didn't live through as kids when these peanut allergies spread.
Peanut butter every day.
What's the deal now? Is there thinking that you got to expose kids to peanuts real quick so they develop an immunity? Or is it important that schools not have peanuts?
So I do encourage early feeding in my practice. So 6 months, I want to see you giving that baby a little bit of peanut butter, eggs, you know, I want it all. As far as the, I'm hearing... We're going to commercial. Okay.
Not commercial. We're winding up.
Okay. As far as the school system and just food allergies are real now. Kids do die from food allergies. And I think that Matt Wilcox and myself are working feverishly to make sure that all kids are safe in our community, especially in the school system.
Well, kid by kid, family by family.
Yes.
Tomiko MacArthur Jackson is keeping you healthy. 22,000 kids as an entity of who go to New Haven Public Schools. Tomiko MacArthur Jackson is also looking out for you as a group, as a member of the Board of Ed. One-on-one as the doctor, as a group, as a Board of Ed member.
Yes.
Fair to say?
Yes, thank you so much. I just wrote that down. I love that.
All right. Well, I loved having you here in the studio. What a pleasure, Tomiko.
Likewise. It's been good.
Thanks for coming on Dateline New Haven on WNHH-FM. Thanks to the miracle man behind the controls, the bravest man in New Haven, and also maybe the most lovable. I think that's going to be, you know, up for debate. WNHH station manager Harry Gross.
Thank you.
We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass inviting you to grab a seat and fly free with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.